Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 713, Interview with Russ Baker. This is being recorded on Memorial Day, May 31st of the year 2010. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Russ Baker, the author of the landmark text Family of Secrets, subtitled The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and The Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. This book just out in softcover by Bloomsbury. Russ, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you very much.
Before we delve back into the hidden history of the last 50 years, something you've done a long way toward revealing to those who were not aware of it, let's tell people how and where they can get the book Family of Secrets, which really, even though we've already done a bunch of interviews and we're going to do several more, I do think it could be said that we've scratched the surface, but no more than that.
So. No, because Family of Secrets is about 500 and some odd pages, more than 1,000 footnotes, and anything that I've touched on here is literally 1 or 2% of what is actually in the book. It may be obtained in hardcover, in paperback, and now, just now, also in Kindle as an e-book, and that's available at the Amazon website. You can also get it if you go into your local bookstore. They should carry it. If they don't, they can order it for you, and you can also get it online and get further information on the book at our website, familyofsecrets.com.
All righty. This is Memorial Day, and I'd like to resume with a point that we just touched on at the tail end of Side 2, and that is we're now in the mid and late 60s. The Vietnam War is raging. George Bush, the elder George Bush, as we have seen, is inextricably linked with intelligence matters, and a fundamental synthesis is presented in Family of Secrets between business matters, in particular petroleum industry business matters, and intelligence matters, as in espionage and covert action. The Bush family in many ways embodying that synthesis. Tell us about Thomas Devine, George Bush, and their little trip to Vietnam, and what you speculate about what they were doing there and what they might have been really up to, as opposed to just a junket.
Well, you know, why would a congressman take a CIA officer or a so-called former CIA officer with him? Why would he take a man who supposedly had been out of the CIA for years? What was the purpose of that? And as I describe in Family of Secrets, the CIA actually was providing some kind of cover for Mr. Devine so he could go on the trip. What we see is that a number of individuals connected to Bush and to the CIA, particularly some of these anti-Castro Cubans, were now in Vietnam involved with an effort to try and use covert operations in the villages of Vietnam to combat the Viet Cong. And this was the so-called pacification program. And there are indications that they may have been there to connect with some individuals who were involved with that and to inspect how this pacification program was going. That's a very nice word, pacification. It basically meant killing the people in villages who were suspected of being Viet Cong sympathizers or otherwise, in some cases, and I'm not attributing this specifically to Bush or the people with him, but generally this pacification program targeted people who were suspect because they were independent figures and leadership figures in those villages.
The Vietnam War, of course, was raging at this time, and a lot of young men were being sent off to fight in this particular war. And again, we should remember that today, as we're recording this, is Memorial Day, when America remembers its fallen from foreign wars. And in Family of Secrets, what you present is networking between powerful corporate interests and the intelligence community, as we've mentioned, networking between families and individuals running through generations. And right in this time period, George W. Bush, the 43rd president of the United States, is presented with the same dilemma that a lot of other young men were presented with at this time, what to do about Vietnam. Tell us about what George Bush did to serve his country in this time period.
Right. Well, so while the father, Poppy Bush, was a staunch supporter of the Vietnam War, his son, W. was at Yale, where he was also a supporter of the Vietnam War. And the grandfather, Senator Prescott Bush, a supporter and so forth. And so they were in an awkward position because, as has been documented repeatedly, wealthy people have very often managed to keep their own sons out of harm's way. And, you know, we see this again and again with war. And that happened there. And so instead of going to Vietnam, they got W into a safe stateside unit with the Texas Air National Guard. And this story is interesting for a number of reasons. It's probably most redolent because of what happened to Dan Rather, the former anchorman of CBS News and correspondent for 60 Minutes, when he produced this, when he aired a story during the 2004 re-election campaign, basically questioning George W. Bush's military service record. And in Family of Secrets, what I do is I explore Bush's service. He very clearly, through favoritism, managed to avoid going to Vietnam, was placed in this unit. Again, through favoritism, he was given an opportunity to be trained to fly a plane. This was not normal because most of the people in the Air National Guard already knew how to fly planes. They'd already flown planes, and this was the reason that they were put into this very desirable position. But he was brought in as with no experience, sent off at great expense, and taught to fly a plane by the Air Force, and then sent over to Houston to join this unit. And as I believe document rather substantively in Family of Secrets, although he had signed a contract to serve 6 years in the Air National Guard, he served only 4 years and basically skipped out, never finished the last 2 years. Of course, of having later becoming president of the United States and sending young Americans into harm's way, in an utterly elective decision to invade Iraq, the fact that he himself, A, didn't serve on the front lines, didn't serve at all over in the overseas theater, and B, when he served in a safe position, rather exciting one, flying a plane where there was no risks beyond whatever risks are entailed with flying a plane domestically, that he just took off and did not finish his service. And as I believe, again, I document extensively in Family of Secrets, there are indications that the paperwork was fudged in order to cover for his disappearance from his unit, with the indication that his father, who at the time was extremely well-connected at the highest levels, just coming in as the head of the Republican Party, was very much in a position to influence that process.
One of the things that you point out in your book also is that despite the fact that he apparently reneged on his stated term in the Texas Air National Guard, he sent an awful lot of National Guardsmen and women, I guess, to serve in combat in Iraq, and a lot of them had not figured at all that they would be in harm's way. And
well, not just that, but they weren't properly trained, and they were given worse equipment and worse protective armor than the regular troops. They really were sitting ducks, and they will talk about that. Members of the Guard will talk about how they never anticipated fighting wars, that they didn't feel they were properly trained for it. Because typically when you join the National Guard, and these are run at the state level, you tend to be involved with helping keep order and assisting in the case of emergencies. And that's what we see in situations like with Hurricane Katrina and what have you. But that was not the situation under George Bush, where he very, without any hesitation at all, sent these people abroad into this incredibly dangerous situation, including members of the Texas National Guard.
One of the things that we touched on this in the first interview, and I'd like to go back to this when we actually get into the substance of W's presidency, but since it is Memorial Day, you mentioned that a Texas journalist and longtime Bush family protege, Mickey Herskowitz, was helping with a puff piece biography of George Bush, and that George Bush had some interesting things to say about what he thought a strong and successful president should do in the late 1990s. Develop that for us, if you would.
Well, I mean, this, first of all, this is a major, one of the biggest of hundreds of fairly big revelations in Family of Secrets. And I'm not sure whether we should reveal this just yet or whether we ought to save this for when we're talking about his actual presidency. Sequentially, I think that the key stuff here is about his guard service. What I discovered in terms of why he seems to have left the guard, and the indications that there was a cover-up. And this is huge because, if you think about it, if the President of the United States just took off from the military and that was established, there is no way that either as a candidate that he could be elected as president. And once he was president, there was no way he would have been reelected. So they were gravely concerned about this in 2004 when the Democratic nominee was John Kerry, a decorated Vietnam veteran. This was a disaster for them, the worst possible scenario. And the Bush people, of course, kept insisting that he had finished his service, but there was no evidence of that. His own officers reported that they had not seen him on the base for more than a year. When he went to Alabama to work on a political campaign, he was supposed to continue his service. He was reported not being seen there either. And in fact, this whole history has been rewritten. I quote in Family of Secrets from accounts and papers like the Washington Post, where they talk about how he went from Texas to Alabama for a very important position on a U.S. Senate campaign, where he was the deputy campaign manager, and that this was the reason that he left his guard unit, but that he continued to serve in the guard in Alabama. Well, the fact of the matter is he didn't continue to serve in the guard in Alabama. And in fact, his position in the campaign itself was not an opportunity, but an excuse. And I actually interviewed the widow of the campaign manager, they themselves having been close friends of the Bush family. And the story that she told me was that the reason George W. Bush was even in Alabama was because he had gotten in some kind of trouble back in Texas, and his father had intervened and had basically ordered him out of state and had told the campaign manager, who was a kind of a lieutenant to the elder Bush, to take W and keep him there, keep him basically out of sight from Texas until whatever it was had blown over.
One of the things that you point out in Family of Secrets, Russ Baker, and that is that the unit, the particular unit that Bush wound up in was, I think, the 147th Fighter Wing, and it was known as the Champagne Unit. We were talking about the Texas Raj earlier. A lot of the little Rajis wound up, to coin a term, in that unit. Again, more networking. Develop that for us, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, this unit, which was a desirable one to be in because you either got to fly planes, which was pretty cool, or just in general stay out of Vietnam, and it was right there in the hometown of Houston. Most of the people in there, not everybody, but a lot of the people in there were the sons of powerful and wealthy families. There also were, I can't remember the number, 8 or 10 members of the Dallas Cowboys football team were put in there. So it was a kind of a squirrel people away type of situation. So that was a sweet deal. And a lot of these guys lived at a particular swing singles apartment complex called Chateau Dijon. And in Family of Secrets, I tell the rather entertaining story, I think, of life there at the chateau, where these guys, when they weren't flying their planes, were basically playing pool volleyball and having barbecues and chasing the girls. So it sure was a far cry from hitting the Mekong Delta.
Yes, indeed. And one of the things, I don't think that going into detail will translate very effectively into radio, but both in your discussion of W's actual term in the Texas Air National Guard and in your discussion of basically what was a psyop in order to discredit Dan Rather and also John Kerry and anyone who might have brought up the issue of W's service, you go into a very meticulous analysis of the documents of the usual behavior of someone in the Texas Air National Guard and comparing these and analyzing them in great detail, which you do, I think creates a very, very, very strong case for, well, really it establishes what W was doing at that time.
Right. Now, let's think about the context here. I mean, if, in fact, all of these stories, and we talked earlier about JFK, we're going to talk about Watergate, all of these things not being what we thought they were. And then we find out that the President of the United States, the man who started this war in Iraq and basically plunged the United States into a state of I don't even know what to call it, but it plunged the world into a kind of newfound sort of chaos that continues today. We don't talk much about what's happening in Afghanistan and Iraq, but people are dying there every day. It's really a tragic situation. And here we are on Memorial Day, and we're not talking about this. We talk abstractly about our heroes and the people who served our country, but we don't talk about these other things, about the people who didn't serve our country or who avoided serving our country while trying to get the country into war, and often, by the way, benefiting from it. If you go all the way back, and I talk about this, the Bush family was involved with helping and fronting for munitions manufacturers all the way back to World War One, basically helping people who were, in the case of World War One, prior to the U.S.'s entrance, selling weapons to both sides. I mean, there is a huge gap, Dave, between the way that American history is presented and what really goes on. And you talk about networks and networking, and of course, I mean, all human beings try to gain advantage in situations. But of course, powerful people are very, very good at gaining advantage, and they're constantly working at that. They're constantly trying to minimize risks, trying to suppress scandal, and trying to gain the informational and strategic advantage that they need to prevail. This is the way that things really work, and this is the way this is not the way that we discuss. And so what you see there with the George W. Bush story with the National Guard is, again, a far cry from what we believe. And if you go around the country, at least half of America thinks that George W. Bush and his family, that they're great Americans, that they're heroic, and you know, their books are bestsellers. George W. has his memoirs coming out. Karl Rove has his book out. Laura's book out. And they are just treated as absolute heroes. And these people know nothing, and I mean nothing, about the kind of revelations that I've come up with in Family of Secrets. And I might add, by the way, we can't get on those shows. We cannot get on to Fox News or even the mainstream shows like Meet the Press, where these folks who are so misguided and so misinformed about what goes on in this country and how decisions are made, they can't even begin to access this information because it's blocked from them.
Well, when one reads Family of Secrets, it becomes only too clear, basically, why America's ice cream has turned to horse manure. And it's something we need to contemplate perhaps more gravely on Memorial Day than we normally do. Really, we should do this every day. But question, Russ Baker. We talk about networking. We're talking about W's Guard Service. This during the Vietnam War. We talk about networking. Somebody he met at this point, somebody who's going to figure very prominently in our discussion of the rise of W, the Saudi connections, Arbusto, and so forth. And that is James R. Bath. Do you want to touch on him now, or do you want to say, obviously, we'll talk about most of his operations later.
Yeah, I mean, later. I'm, as you know, I'm a little leery of overwhelming people with names because what I do with Family of Secrets, and I urge people, please, when you get the book, don't skip around. Start on page one and read every page, every paragraph, every sentence, because I very carefully introduce these people and these relationships. And if you don't do it that way, it's just a big confusing thing. I'll speak generally about this. When George W. Bush was in the National Guard, he had a good friend. And that was this fellow that you referred to. And this man ends up taking on an important role in Sub Rosa operations that the father Bush is involved with over the years. And these appear to be connected to Iran-Contra and to a pipeline involving very wealthy Saudis. And the backstory there is that in the National Guard, when Bush left, when George W. Bush left his guard unit prematurely, many years later, when this subject came up, the White House released documents showing that Bush had failed to take his annual flight qualifying exam, physical exam, and then that, they said that was a minor thing, but because of that, he wasn't able to fly, and that's why he stopped flying. Well, that's ludicrous on its face, but in any case, they also said that the fact that he stopped flying and didn't take his physical was not unusual. In fact, that there was a second person, and they released a redacted document where you can't see the name, but it shows that someone else around the same time also stopped flying because he didn't take his physical. Now, they used that with the press quite effectively to blunt the notion that there was something really wrong with whatever George W. Bush had done. What they didn't reveal was who that other person was, and it was this James Bath, who, unlike Bush, was a great and extremely talented flyer who loved to fly. And what I raise is the possibility that Mr. Bath basically fell on his sword for Bush, so that they could, when necessary, point out that there wasn't just one, but two. And indeed, what we see is several years after that, Mr. Bath, a man of very, very modest means, suddenly ends up in a business where he is basically partnered with two of the wealthiest people from Saudi Arabia.
Yes, last names well known to this audience, Bin Mahfouz and Bin Laden. But this, again, for future discussion in our analysis of Family of Secrets. More networking, Russ Baker. You talk about, and in our next interview, we're going to get into the Watergate affair, something in which George H.W. Bush figures prominently, and a narrative that plays out in very different fashion than the public has been led to believe. But an individual who figured prominently, one of the reasons you were talking about how people should not just skip around in this book, and I amen that to the nth degree. When you begin studying people, whether it's James R. Bath and his networking from the Texas Air National Guard, or another individual who became known as a hero in Watergate, but who also tracks way back to, among other things, the events of 11-22-63, let's talk about that rock of jurisprudence, Leon Jaworski, and how he figures into the narrative of George Bush and some of these other people.
Well, I mean, we haven't started to tell the story of Watergate yet, so I don't know how quite to do that. I can certainly give Jaworski's background, but it only becomes significant when we see what actually befell Richard Nixon.
All right, yeah, then let's defer analysis of Jaworski's career to the next interview. But suffice it to say that he networks with all of these individuals at this particular point in time. Let's in a sense, sort of set the table for our next interview, which is going to talk about Watergate and other matters. Richard Nixon, obviously, and George H.W. Bush were networking in a very significant way. And in fact, Prescott Bush appears to have been one of the people who helped to elevate Richard Nixon into politics in the first place. And although Nixon was a protege of the Eastern establishment, he also was fearful of it. Richard Nixon was beginning to alienate some of the same people that had brought him to the dance, the petroleum industry and Richard Nixon, and what began going wrong?
Right. Well, actually, the thing that intrigued me in this regard was the similarities, not differences, but similarities between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy. Of course, much is made about their rivalry in 1960 and so forth. But in fact, I discovered that they actually were rather friendly. They were rather friendly in the Senate, and I think even liked each other to a certain extent. And this is very important because we tend to look at history. We sort of use the great man theory of history. We look at these individuals, and when things happen, we assume they happened because this person wanted them to happen. But really, there are these tremendous forces that we don't look at, and what Family of Secrets is about these tremendous forces that are doing much more in some ways to shape our history than these individuals being largely pawns. And so what you see with Richard Nixon is that once he gets to the top, there's nowhere to go from the presidency. And so, you know, what do you do as president? What are your objectives? Well, in many cases, the objectives are to sort of seal your legacy. And you seal your legacy by doing something noteworthy. And that usually has to be something transformative, something that changes the global equation, something that secures something for the American people, whether it is, in the case of FDR, you know, the introduction of Social Security and other such things, Johnson with the Great Society, Medicare, and so forth. And so what was Richard Nixon's legacy going to be? Well, he couldn't have a legacy by continuing to serve the same corporate interests, and he saw that, and so he began trying to identify ways in which he could stand out. one way in which he could stand out was to basically end some of the hostilities in the world. And as much as he did escalate in Vietnam, that was part of an effort on his part, described in Family of Secrets with Henry Kissinger, a dual strategy where they were attempting to get out of Vietnam. That's not to defend the way he handled it, but that's in fact what he was trying to do. He was trying to get out of Vietnam and to end that war. And he was also doing secret back-channel negotiations with the Chinese and with the Soviets, and that is identical, as we now are beginning to learn, about what John F. Kennedy was doing back in 1962-63 that so alarmed these interests, the Pentagon, the military contractors, the intelligence apparatus, a lot of these large corporations, very alarmed by that. And then Nixon began doing some of the same things. And so we see that when he gets to the top, he begins sort of shedding his handlers. He rejects George H.W. Bush as a vice president, and he begins moving very secretively. And by the way, as you know, David, of course, Nixon is always talked about being secretive and paranoid, and that's always spoken of as if there is no context for that or that he was crazy. In fact, more and more I'm convinced that Richard Nixon's secretiveness and paranoia were entirely justified and were based on what he knew about how things really worked.
We're down now to our last 3 minutes plus on this side, the second side of this interview, and we'll talk about how in a sense, the suckfish began abandoning the sharks who brought him to the waters and what those sharks turned around and did to him in our next talk. But you mentioned, in this same context of being paranoid, something I did not know is that Nixon had attempted to get a hold of the CIA's files on Kennedy's assassination and was rebuffed. Develop that for us, if you would.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, he was obviously traumatized by finding himself almost inexplicably lured to Dallas to be there the day that Kennedy was shot, and it made an indelible impression on him about what can happen to people who get on the wrong side of powerful forces. I don't think he ever believed that it was a lone assassin, and hence his remark about Spiro Agnew being his assassination insurance. And so he remained interested in that, and years later, when he was president, his top advisors, Haldeman and Ehrlichman, remembered that Nixon used to always use this phrase, the Bay of Pigs thing. And he was very elliptical. He didn't share much with these fellows, even these guys who were among his most trusted. He still was afraid to tell them what he really thought or what he really knew. And so he used code words. And when he talked about the Bay of Pigs thing, well, what was the thing? If it was the Bay of Pigs, he would have just said Bay of Pigs. But he said the Bay of Pigs thing. And his aides were convinced that these were code words for something else, something that would be triggered in people's minds when you mentioned Bay of Pigs. And they felt that this was, in fact, an oblique reference to the Kennedy assassination. Now, you find very interestingly, in Family of Secrets, I obtained a letter that I reprint part of there, where he writes to Mr. Kendall of PepsiCo, who brought him to Dallas in 1963. He writes to him some years later, and he says, you know, I really want to catch up with you, and I want to hear more about what you know about the Bay of Pigs thing. And this is very, very interesting. What could Mr. Kendall of PepsiCo possibly know, either about the Bay of Pigs itself or about the Kennedy assassination? So that's very, very interesting. But pretty clearly, Nixon wanted to know more about what had happened to John F. Kennedy and what was going on, and about this behind-the-scenes power struggle in the United States between the visible forces of democracy, being the president and Congress and the judiciary, and the unseen forces, these power spheres that are constantly in there trying to shape things to their own advantage.
Russ, we are all out of time on this side. Just encapsulating briefly, when Nixon actually sent to the CIA to get the files on the Kennedy assassination, they told him to forget about it. And we'll talk more about the whole Bay of Pigs thing in our next interview, but we are all out of time in this side two. For the record, program number 713, interview with Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets. For Russ Baker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening this on Memorial Day, May 31st of 2010.